Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ed Pulford, one of the hosts of the channel, coming to you today from an almost improbably snowy Sapporo in Japan. Today on the show, we'll have two guests, Derek Hurd, who's a senior lecturer in Chinese studies at Lancaster University in the UK, and Gong Song, who is associate professor in the School of Chinese at the University of Hong Kong. And they'll be talking about their co-edited volume, The Cosmopolitan Dream, Transnational Chinese Masculinities in a Global Age, which was published last year, 2018, by Hong Kong University Press. Now, from the economic to the political, the ecological to the cultural realms, China's global rise has been analysed from many perspectives in recent years. But questions over gender, which arguably are just as pressing as these other perspectives, and particularly over masculinities, haven't been asked so often, especially in the context of China's contact with the wider world. Fortunately, however, our guests are already established as among the primary contributors to a steadily growing body of work on Chinese masculinity and manhood, and that's why it's such a pleasure to have the chance to talk to them today. Derek Hurd and Gong Song's new volume, The Cosmopolitan Dream, approaches the question of Chinese masculinities in transnational contexts from a brilliantly diverse range of perspectives. As specialists in media, language, literature, gender studies, and anthropology join forces to discuss the subject in many revealing contexts, from domestic film and televisual portrayals of globe-trotting Chinese men to the experiences of Chinese migrant fathers working in Ethiopia, Chinese students studying abroad in the United States, or Chinese male gangsters appearing on German or Japanese TV. Readers will get a rich sense of just how importantly masculinity figures in all China's global entanglements and how it's changing amidst these. Hurd and Song expertly marshal the array of material covered here in these punchy chapters, doing a great job of tying themes together and drawing out the specific commonalities to many experiences which make this a highly relevant read. In many ways, we might suggest, therefore, that this book embodies in its very form the kind of cosmopolitanism that the title refers to. There's something for everyone here, and it's all adeptly curated by the editors who bring everything together into a coherent whole. But in any case, to discuss this ambitious project further, I'd like to welcome the two editors, Derek Hurd and Gong Song. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, Derek and Gong, thanks very much for agreeing to appear. I'd like to ask each of you, if you would, to begin by introducing yourselves and saying something about how you became interested in your topics of study. So, Derek, why don't you go ahead?
Sure. Well, thank you very much for having us on the podcast. And my interest in Chinese masculinities really began to emerge during my master's studies on Chinese women, where I was looking at the ways in which the Women's Federation in China had strategized to combat domestic violence in China. And clearly, the perpetrators of domestic violence were largely men. And as I proceeded with my master's thesis, this was at the University of Edinburgh, I began to think more and more about the kinds of different masculinities that were in practice in everyday life, and that also could be found discursively in representations in the media. And so I decided to take up the challenge of looking at masculinities in China as a kind of follow-on from my master's in my doctoral project. And I moved to the University of Westminster, where I was guided by the excellent and inspiring Professor Harriet Evans, who has worked on Chinese women and gender for many decades and has produced some really insightful works. And so under her supervision, I then did a doctoral project on white-collar men in China. And the reason why I studied white-collar men was because when I went to China, to Beijing, in the mid-2000s, this was really a representation of masculinity that one could not avoid. There were images of the successful white-collar man appearing on TV adverts, on billboards, and in TV dramas, and so on and so forth. So that's really the trajectory of my my early years studying masculinities, and I've just carried on, more or less, doing masculinities into my my full-time job.
Yeah. Right, right, right. Great. And how about you, Gon? What's been your trajectory?
Oh, thank you, Ed. It's my pleasure to talk with you and share with you my research on Chinese masculinity. I think my interest in Chinese masculinity started with my PhD dissertation, which is on the male lead, the male. The title of my PhD thesis is "The Fragile Scholar," so I was focusing on the image of the effeminate scholar type, scholar image in Yuan drama and the pre-modern Chinese literature. You know, so the question was why this type of image, who was obviously regarded as effeminate or feminine by today's audience, was regarded as an ideal masculine or the ideal lover in pre-modern China. So that was the central central topic of my PhD, and that thesis was developed into a monograph, which is my first book, The Fragile Scholar, Power and the Masculinity in Chinese Culture. And from there on, I shifted my interest to more modern and contemporary types of masculinity, and I was interested in the change of the models of masculinity in China in the past century. So as Derek said, we collaborated on the monograph on men and masculinities in contemporary China, which is an interdisciplinary study on both the representation and everyday life of men and masculinity in China. And our central, the basic argument or conclusion of the book is that masculinity is becoming increasingly hybridized. So there's no such a thing as a monolithic Chinese masculinity in today's China. Or it's meaningless to talk about a unique Chinese masculinity, because masculinity is becoming hybridized and influenced by global trends in China. And so that's my second book, collaborated with Derek. I'm now working on a project on Chinese TV and gender politics and Chinese TV. So that also involves how men and masculinity are represented in popular culture in today's China.
I see. Yeah. I see. And you mentioned, Gong, that, as you say, you had a previous jointly authored book that you worked on together. How was it that the collaboration between the two of you came about?
Oh, I just saw Derek's thesis, PhD thesis, online one day when I was in Australia, because before I came to Hong Kong, I taught in the Australian National University. So I have been working on this project, and I've finished the three chapters, but I find that it's insufficient, or it's not... a good idea to focus on representation only. So I was trying to look for someone who also working in this field, and just accidentally I find Derek's profile, and he uploaded the entire thesis online, and I read it. I find, oh, this is great. This is exactly the person that I'm looking for. So I just sent an email. I never met him before. He was teaching at University of Westminster at that time. So I just emailed him and suggested the idea that probably we could work together to combine the study of media and representation with the ethnographic study of men in daily life. And then he agreed. And then we just exchanged emails and collaborated.
Yeah. Fantastic. Yeah. Oh, well, that's the kind of, I guess, yeah, serendipity that can occur, especially with, online academic exchange. That's
brilliant. Yeah.
But Derek, could you, perhaps give us an account from your side of how the difference between co-authoring a book, as you did on your previous project, and co-editing, which has been this one, works? I mean, in terms of the division of labor, I think these are kind of questions that anyone involved in similar endeavors is always curious about. How did that kind of work out between the two of you?
Yes, they are two very different endeavors. So starting with the co-authored book that was published in 2014 on men and masculinities in contemporary China, as Gung said just now, he had already prepared some material, some chapters on representations of masculinities in various media, and my thesis and my subsequent work had quite a substantial component of ethnographically informed research and writing on contemporary Chinese masculinities. So we didn't have too much of a problem in bringing the main body of the book together, because Gung was able to supply chapters on the representations. I was able to supply chapters of more ethnographic aspects of masculinities in the family, in the workplace, in the leisure activities. It then became a question of reading each other's drafts and then reworking our own drafts so that they could reflect the ideas and the themes that were present in the other persons. So through that process of redrafting, we began to bring a coherence to our material, which had been obviously developed in isolation, but we had to clearly bring a thematic conceptual coherence to it. So it was through that process of redrafting that we managed to do that. And then for the introduction, again, it was a question of Gung preparing a draft on the representation side, introducing them, and myself from the more ethnographic side. And again, through a similar process of just viewing each other's drafts and then reworking our own drafts to make sure that we reflected each other's ideas and thoughts and came to some kind of agreement over the particular theoretical line we would take. And through that process made it happen. Now, when it came to the edited volume, it's more a kind of management of a project management, I would say, that editors need to be involved with. So in this case, the majority of the time was taken up with emailing the various collaborators and looking. Obviously, we had to look through their various drafts. We divided out the work and we had to put in our own thoughts, send back our suggestions to the different authors, And then there was a kind of crossing of drafts and in these email exchanges where we just took on a kind of complementary roles to each other. So if one person took the lead on reading through and commenting on one particular chapter, then the other person would then offer a sort of second view of it. When it came to the introduction, this time I took the lead in drafting the majority of the introduction, and then Gung came back with his parts that he inputted into the introduction and his set suggestions for reworking my parts. And through that process, again, to-ing and fro-ing, we got to the final version. Right. So I think our experience in working together on the co-authored book had been very smooth. And so editorially in the second project, we were already set up with a good working relationship. I think I would emphasize here, for me, that the key thing is a working relationship that is built on kind of understanding of the other person's working style. And if both people can kind of cohabit, you know, or come to terms with each other's working styles, then there isn't a problem. And I think in this case, Gung and I have fairly similar working styles, I think, so no problem. Right.
I think that comes across pretty well, actually. Yeah, the introduction is very seamless. There's no indication that there are kind of two divergent or discordant voices there. So it's clear that you found a great collaborative kind of mode there. Having got a sense of where it comes from and how it came about, why don't we jump right into the book? Derek, if I could get you to carry on, really, by taking us into the introduction that you've just mentioned. Could you say something in general, perhaps a little more about the broad topic of Chinese masculinities, why it's an important focus of study at this point, and why, in particular, the transnational dimension is what you chose to focus on?
Sure. I think nobody can have failed to notice the economic and political expansion of China's presence at a global level over the last few decades. As you yourself mentioned, Ed, in your introduction, Chinese gender perspectives are quite often not the most prominent in the story of this rise of China. So that was one aspect of our desire, one aim to write this book. One aim that we had was to bring focus to the gender dimensions of China's expansion into the global economy, global politics, and so on and so forth. And at the same time, to put a particular focus on masculinity, because masculinity is often kind of double marginalized, as it were. Gender is already marginalized in the sort of general discourse, mainstream discourse. And masculinity, let's say, if we take the example of academic studies on gender, is sidelined even more, because over the past few decades, women's issues and women's status, quite rightly, I should say, have been at the forefront of gender studies. Now, the desire to bring a spotlight to masculinities is not in any way to try to reduce the amount of work on women's issues and equality. I think there's plenty of work that can still be done on that. That's an ongoing struggle. It's just to bring the effort here, or the aim here, is to bring masculinity studies into the picture at the same time. And the reason why transnational dimensions are very important is because coming back to something Gung said in his initial remarks about there not being any one particular Chinese masculinity that has got any a model of Chinese masculinity in and of itself untainted, untouched by other cultural forces. This has become a real issue in a globalizing world. We still have a mainstream discourse in most countries around the world, if not all countries around the world, in which the idea of cultures are still seen as inherently belonging to particular lands, as relatively unchanging, and as kind of being able to, one can define them through a list of characteristics, and this is a really problematic view of culture and all cultural facets such as gender, as much scholarship in recent decades has shown. So by taking a transnational view, we can show very clearly that the hybridity, as Gung was saying, of Chinese masculinities, and by extension, hybridity of Chinese culture. We can't talk about masculinities without also being aware of the hybridity of the culture in which they're being produced.
No, that's absolutely right. And I think taps into something very important for anyone looking at any dimension, I think, of China today, not least because the Chinese government itself would perhaps often like to forward a view of a sort of monolithic Chinese culture, which, of course, is very difficult to maintain when you're on the ground there. And the nuanced studies that are present there throughout this edited volume really, really bring that diversity out. Gung, could I turn to you perhaps? As Derek mentioned, there's a lot of diversity in the present day sphere of Chinese masculinities. But of course, change over time is also a key dimension to looking at this in the present. And it seems that really resonating throughout all the chapters in this book, which I should mention is divided into two distinct parts, although not mutually exclusive ones, between representations in part one and sort of enactments and practices in part two. Resonating throughout all of those chapters are these kind of historical junctures, which we might see as key in the contemporary era of Chinese masculinities, the end of the Mao era, the Tiananmen Square massacre, the return of Hong Kong to mainland control, and I suppose the rise of China more generally in the last two decades. Could you give us some sense, especially because you've studied it with great historical depth, as you mentioned, from your PhD onwards, how these historical junctions have informed the broad contours of Chinese masculinities and how it has changed in recent decades?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Maybe I'll start with the title of the book, The Cosmopolitan Dream. So why it is called The Cosmopolitan Dream? It comes from Xi Jinping administration's slogan of the Chinese dream, the Zhongguo Meng, you know. And the cosmopolitan dream refers to not just masculinity, but gender in general, or Chinese subjectivity in general. There's a trend, or there's a tendency to have to harbor this this wish, this desire to transcend locality, to become cosmopolitan, okay? And then this is in line with the government's promotion of the image of China in the new era, which is a more open, modern, and as the slogan said, as the slogan goes, to connect track with the world. Okay. But at the same time, there is a paradox that is, on the one hand, there's a popular, there's a general desire, general wish to be connected with the world, to be more cosmopolitan by the general population and the government. But on the other hand, in media, in the Chinese media, we can find a strong desire, or emphasis on confidence, confidence of Chinese culture, okay, or the negotiation of China's place in the world by dint of its size, by dint of its economic growth, you know, and in the media, Chinese film and TV, we'll find lots of examples. And this is maybe a new trend. As you said, there's a, you know, a historical change of masculinity. For instance, the Confucian, you know, the Confucian type of masculinity, the ideal man would be the junzi, right? Mm. Who show little interest in women, but highly self-disciplined and is devoted himself to the political, lofty political causes. Okay. Mm. And probably that was the dominant official discourse during Confucian or pre-modern time. And in Maoist culture, the hero, the revolutionary hero, fighters who is selfless and also show, you can say, is a kind of desexualized because there's no romance, no heterosexual romance between the male and female fighters. Okay, so like Lei Feng and like the communist fighters in the model drama, model plays, during the Maoist period, and that type of man may be regarded as the predominant type of ideal masculine during the Maoist period. So it was changing time. So from Confucian time to the Maoist to the contemporary entrepreneur, transnational businessman or haigui returnees from overseas, we probably could argue that for each time, for each epoch in time, there was a predominant hegemonic type of male images. But at the same time, we can find other marginal or different types of men represented in film, literature, and the media. And this is cosmopolitan or cosmopolitanism with Chinese characteristics. For me, this was a new trend. This is a new trend and also is a very interesting type of male images emerging in Chinese media, which deserve our attention today.
Sure, sure. Well, I think we'll get on in the course of the interview to more into how some of these historical precedents and these models from much longer ago in Chinese history remain sort of current and play a role in curious ways in the present. But you've just drawn us very neatly into the first part of the volume and your own chapter, in fact,
yep.
Cosmopolitanism with Chinese characteristics.
Yes.
Could you say a bit more about the representations that you studied and that have been something that you focused on for a while? You particularly focus on TV dramas. So could you say what some of these dramas are and what kind of visions of masculinity, particularly this transnational business masculinity you mentioned, come out in those TV programs?
Okay, yeah, thank you. The reason why I'm interested in television programs is because there are already an established body of research on Chinese film, but compared with Chinese film, Chinese TV is relatively understudied. But as you know, there are over 1 billion TV viewers in China, and television is becoming a new symbol, new carrier of China's soft power in today's world. And so I think that more scholarly interest should be paid to this genre of popular culture. And also Chinese TV dramas, why it is important? Because it reflects a negotiation between the state and the individual, which might be particular peculiar to China, to the social situation in China, because all TV stations are state-owned, and all the TV programs have to undergo heavy-handed censorship before they are allowed to air. At the same time, television is a highly commercialized field. It's highly profitable, and there are TV production companies who make a fortune by producing TV dramas because of the large market, right? So that's why I find this is a very important, highly influential form of a popular culture, and especially from the perspective of gender, we can find different types of male and female images are constructed and promoted in the TV programs. So back to your question, the first chapter of the book, Cosmopolitanism with Chinese Characteristics, in this chapter, I examined three most recently popular TV dramas, and I've been focusing on the transnational businessman or the haigui returnees from overseas, because they are believed to be the portion of Chinese population who are most cosmopolitan. So in the dramas, their language proficiency, they can speak good English, and their knowledge about Western world, their knowledge about how to drink coffee and wine, and how to play golf, all these are represented as a signifier of their modernity, modern identity, and their cosmopolitan identity. So I find this is a very, very interesting phenomenon. And in other chapters, we also have, other chapters also covered like German, Chinese man in German TV drama, and transnational trans masculinity in Hong Kong films, and gay identity, gay masculinity in Beijing Story, which is a novel, and also masculinity in Ha Jin's Chinese, overseas Chinese writer Ha Jin's works, and also masculinity in Feng Tang's novel. Feng Tang is also a popular Chinese writer today. So it would be impossible to exhaustively, cover, because as you said, this is a very ambitious project, transnational masculinity. So ideally, if you could cover the transnational representation between China and the most major countries like China and Japan, China and the United States, China and Africa, China and Europe, I think that might be an ideal picture, but we were not just, not impossible. It's just impossible for us to cover all these topics. And so, so I think basically we just, all the chapters focus on this paradoxical interplay between a desire to be cosmopolitan and also a desire to retain or highlight the Chinese identity or the Chineseness.
I think that's it. And it's, as I mentioned too, a very sort of cosmopolitan presentation of all these things too, because as you say, we have Arnhild Johanna Höfler talking about German crime television series, this Tatort, and how Chinese figures appear in that. Sheldon Liu talking about film representations. Hongwei Bao, who is also, I should note to listeners, been a guest on a previous New Books in East Asian Studies podcast, so look that out, talking about gay identity. And then Lejo Su talking about this particularly interesting question of one masculinity, the historical kind of Confucian ideal of the male scholar. Derek, I wonder if I could turn to you on this particular subject, because you have done a lot of work with overseas Chinese businessmen and as well as those you mentioned in Beijing. Could you say something about the place of this kind of literati or erudite scholar identity, and how that figures within this sort of transnational business identity of some of the Chinese men you've worked with?
Yes, I have conducted interviews in London in around 2014 with Chinese middle class, one would say businessmen. Usually these were, or often these were men who had come to the UK to study for master's and PhD, but not exclusively. Some of them had already achieved higher education degrees in China and then came over to work in the UK. So these were all men in professional occupations, and they had a very high-level education behind them. And what became clear to me was that, and what was explicitly addressed very clearly and thoroughly by two of them, was the attention that they were paying to historical models of Chinese masculinity, specifically Confucian models, but not exclusively Confucian models of masculinity, such as the Junzi. Also, Buddhist ideas as well were informing the way that they were thinking about their own masculinity. There were also several of them who articulated particular attraction or affiliation with what could be considered as conventional Confucian family ideas of filiality, of responsible fatherhood, of containment of behavior, especially in public, with regard to women, with not behaving badly in the ways that they saw or they characterized some British men as behaving in terms of excessive drinking and fighting and so on. So there was this sense from all of the majority of my informants that their time in the UK had caused them to reflect more at length on their own sense of what it meant to be a Chinese transnationally mobile man. And the ways in which they were constructing their masculinities, therefore, were maybe clearer to them in some ways than if they had remained in China, in a sense that they were deliberately reaching for ideas of moral masculinity that they were drawing from the Confucian canon. So, for example, there would be some of them would talk to me about the inadequacy of the models of masculinity put forward in what had hitherto been the mainstream gender discourses in China, which had not drawn so much on historical models, but were more consumerist models of masculinity, drawing from Western notions of middle class consumerism, or earlier models of socialist masculinity, of course, are now considered passé. The ones that Gung was mentioning earlier, worker peasant soldier from the Mao era. So there's this sense that to define themselves as Chinese, they needed to go back into a historical hinterland of models of masculinity. And the one in particular that I've written about in a couple of articles is this notion of the Junzi masculinity. And they're not coming up with this idea by themselves. There is an intellectual discourse. There are public intellectuals such as Yu Chouyu, Yao Zhongqiu, who are writing about Junzi masculinity as an appropriate archetype for educated middle class or educated elite, if you like, men to base their own sense of masculinity upon. Now, there's a danger in this, in that it's inherently class driven, and that it excludes men, contemporary men, contemporary Chinese men, who are not from the well-educated middle classes, from this kind of elevated, historically infused elite masculinity. So there's a sense that this drive to produce a kind of hybrid Confucian, scholarly, educated, but at the same time, business savvy, globalized, cosmopolitan, mobile masculinity is a maneuver by middle-class men, whether conscious or not, to shore up, to produce a kind of status, social status, that privileges them towards other kinds of men, and not just men who are poorer than them, but men from entrepreneurs who, you know, the Baofahu, these suddenly rich industrialists and businessmen who don't come from a very well-educated background. And this is not to neglect the fact that women, of course, historically have been excluded from being junzi. Now, there's nothing to say that theoretically that women could be women could not be junzi in a contemporary age, but the junzi archetype is so freighted with notions of masculinity, privileged masculinity, a masculinity that is high up in the hierarchy, associated with men. It's kind of difficult for women to get the same purchase on that in contemporary society.
That's really interesting. And I think what you were saying there about the possible implications of trying to capture junzi or privileged junzi identity as a way of, as you say, shoring up a sort of more elite male groups speaks of how there can be a kind of class analysis that cross-cuts the gender analysis throughout this book. To mention again, Hong Wei Bao's chapter says really interesting things about a kind of Marxist class-based gay identity that emerges in certain transnational scenarios. And equally, the Le Zhousu chapter that I mentioned describes this kind of emergence of a neo-one masculinity in a migratory context, where you have elevated or very intelligent Chinese men abroad whose class status is suddenly transformed by the fact that they are in a new society where their maleness and their particular strength are not valorized in the same way. In any case, though, the final chapter in that first part is the Feng Tang one by Pamela Hunt that you mentioned, Gung. But perhaps we'll move on now to chapter two and turn back to you, Gung. Chapter two actually begins with a really interesting chapter by Jamie Coates. Part two begins with a really interesting chapter by Jamie Coates about Li Xiaomu, a Chinese emigrant to Japan, who has gone through many kind of manifestations of Chinese masculinity and as viewed in sort of China's near abroad in Japan. This kind of draws attention to the influence of East Asia, not just the kind of hegemonic, perhaps Euro-American forms of masculinity that today are present in China, but also the role that Korea and Japan play. Could you say a bit more in general about Korea and Japan and the kind of male representations and practices that have or have not had an effect on Chinese masculinities in the present?
I guess probably there are two questions. One is masculinity and the space. I think this is one of the theoretical framework for the whole book, and we also mentioned it in the introduction. That is, the significance of studying men transnationally is masculinity and femininity, and not just performance, but also it is a construction or a production of space. So that means what kind of man you are is not does not depend on who you are, but where you are. you know. A Chinese man like Li Xiaomu, who migrated to a foreign country, this migration will bring forth changes to his masculinity, to his behavior, and to his identity as a man. So I think this book can be regarded as a good start in exploring this dynamic interplay between gender and space, which is, I think this is a potentially a fruitful area of exploration. And also, as you said, this question also involves the influence of Korean and Japanese popular culture on Chinese masculinity, which is a hot issue today. I was interviewed by several media outlets on this topic. For instance, they are interested why this so-called pan-East Asian soft masculinity increasingly popular in China, and why there are more people wear makeup or male beauty products in China. And definitely, I agree that there is influence of Korean and Japanese popular culture, like K-pop and K-drama. And some scholars attribute this to a shared heritage among these countries. That is the Confucian scholar masculinity. But some Korean scholars would deny that. They wouldn't agree with that. So this is there's debate, you know, on whether the soft masculinity or male beauty in today's East Asia have anything to do with the fragile scholar, the Confucian scholar type masculinity in the past. But I think it is undeniable fact that is this type of man, this type of image is particularly popular in East Asian countries, whereas in European and American society, maybe they're not that popular or they cannot be tolerated by mainstream media in the West. Yes, and I also have done some research on the Korean wave in both mainland China and Hong Kong. And I would say that the impact, the influence was enormous. Young people, especially, you know, students, high school and university students, they were heavily influenced by Korean pop culture. Right. Yes, and this is a very interesting case study in terms of the flow of image and flow of discourse in terms of gender in today's globalized world.
I would, yeah, I'd agree very much, and that comes through in the volume as a whole too, to the point even where, as you mentioned in your chapter and as is present in some others, specific TV formats travel between countries. And so if you imagine that characters within those are being transposed from one place to another, it certainly opens up a lot of questions around the kind of communication there between not just the global dimension, but also the regional East Asian side of things. As part two progresses, we have Jin Feng's chapter on Thailand and the promotion of a sort of vision of masculinity through gastronomic expertise, which is really fascinating. And then a trio of chapters, 9, 10, and 11, which all look at fatherhood by Lin Song, Miriam Dreesen, and Tingyu Kang. Derek, perhaps I can turn to you. You alluded briefly earlier in your comments to some of your interlocutors' interest in fatherhood as a component of a modern masculine identity. Could you say something a bit more about how the role of the classic breadwinner, that role for a father is unfolding in contemporary masculine discourse, and how that interlocks with the broader changes in masculinities that we've discussed so far?
Yes, the breadwinner model of masculinity, I think, is still the The main, if you like, we can say it's got a hegemonic dimension to it as a kind of ideal of male success in contemporary Chinese society. It's a difficult one for men to negotiate, because especially when it comes to the middle class men that I've talked to, the white collar men that I've been talking with over several years, because on the one hand, their ideal or the way they see themselves in their very modern masculinity that they aspire to represent is through portraying themselves as very attentive to gender equality in the relationship, in the marital relationship or in the partner relationship. And it's all the way through to discussing ideas and decisions with their partners before going ahead with anything. However, when it comes to the crunch, men often have admitted to me that they still wish to, still feel they have to have the final word on decision-making in the family. And I think this is linked to the breadwinning ideal. It's a kind of sense of masculine status that it hinges upon being the one who brings in the most money, the higher salary, and a loss of face, conversely, if one's wife earns more. Although clearly there are instances in China where female partners are earning more than male partners. And in fact, I found that amongst blue-collar workers, that's a much more widely accepted notion. The idea there being that the more money that can be brought into the family, the better. But when a man aspires to climb up to a higher social status of masculinity, middle-class elite masculinity, there is even an idea that one's wife not working then becomes a means of demonstrating that you've made it. You've succeeded as a man because you earn enough to the extent that your wife doesn't need to work. So I think that breadwinner ideal is still there. And I think if you look at the chapters by Miriam Dreesen and Ting Yu Kang in the book, and even Lin Song's work on the TV series, Dad, Where Are We Going? We can still see this breadwinner ideal, this sort of the man associated, the male in the family, the father, the husband, bringing in the bulk of the earnings. So in Lin Song's chapter on the TV series Dad, Where Are We Going, which looks at fathers and sons and puts them into situations outdoors for them to contend with, Lin found that although there are contestations of masculinities, there's still in terms of how harsh they should be or how tender they should be to the child, in terms of the relationship between the husband and the wife, it's still fairly conventional in that the husband has more authority and deals with the kind of wider dimensions of the family rather than the domestic space per se. And then the sort of seen as the main breadwinner still. And then in the fathers in Miriam Dreesen's chapter, who are blue collar workers going to Africa, they are driven to look overseas for work, often by a sense that their sense of masculinity is being eroded in China because their wife may be earning more, or they're not than them, or that they're not earning as much as other men in their peer group, and so they then seize upon this opportunity to go overseas and make more money through the overseas work in Africa. And by doing that, they help the family, but also shore up their sense of breadwinning masculinity. Mm-hmm. And in Ting Yu Kang's chapter about birth tourism in the United States, the woman is sent over to The wife is sent over to the States to have the child so that the child can get U.S. citizenship. And the man demonstrates, the husband who's left in China often demonstrates his masculinity, again through a breadwinning practice of sending huge sums of money over to help facilitate the birth of the child in America. So I think the breadwinner model is still there, although it's clearly being practiced in different versions in contemporary China.
And in those latter two chapters in particular, the Eason and Kang chapters, we get a really stark sense of that and the negotiations and tensions that emerge as the breadwinner role is continues to be valorized, even as ideas about being a more caring, sort of softer father figure are also in the mix, if you like. And I think that the tremendous distances and the real up close and personal kind of feeling that that both those chapters convey is a real strength of the book. Finally, Gong, I'll perhaps turn back to you. The last chapter of the book by Xia Zhang deals with an issue which Derek alluded to there, the question of partnering and male-female relationships. In the earlier case with fatherhood, we're dealing with mature relationships and how partners negotiate their respective responsibilities towards children. But what emerges in the final chapter, Xia Zhang's chapter, is a really kind of gritty and really contentious, if you like, field of relationships between these kind of global men and women, indeed, and the unfolding kind of picture of masculinity among foreign students in the US. Given that your research deals with some of these Haigui figures and indeed their sort of, aquatic cousins that Xia outlines there, the Hai Dai and a whole load of other Hai-based figures who are people who've studied overseas and returned to China or remained overseas. Could you say something about the kind of the way that masculinity has been shaped by the experiences of men and women who are both outside China in the context like the one described in this final chapter?
Yes, I think this Hai Dai phenomenon, it shows kind of anxiety, right? Because masculinity ultimately is a type of anxiety. This is true for every man. So all men are worrying. They're anxious that they are not masculine enough, that they cannot live up to the standards of people's expectations. And men and women outside of China, maybe I can comment from the perspective of representation. As I mentioned earlier, there's a popular imagination of life of Chinese students overseas or Chinese migrants overseas. And in this representation, we can always see imagined conflicts between cultures, China and the West. And generally, all foreigners are imagined as a whole, as the other, okay. So in these TV dramas or films, it's very often to see that these men from China or people from China are encountering the so-called cultural shock or cultural difference, which in most cases are not real problems. Okay, but it shows the kind of representation of foreign countries by Chinese people or by Chinese TV producers and targeted at domestic audience. So sometimes, if you compare the representation with accounts by Chinese students or Chinese people who have been living abroad. And then we find this very interesting comparison. It reveals, you know, the gap between the imagination, the imagined life of these people and their real problems, their real experience overseas. Another thing I could mention is nationalism. Again, this is a paradox. Someone would say that, you know, the most patriotic people nowadays are Chinese living abroad. Why those people are supposed, you know, they are exposed to Western culture and they got the degree, they studied overseas, they got a degree from Western universities. But they are patriotic. They love China most. So think about the Olympic rally, you know, the torch rally and other events. In most of the cases, they are defenders. They are defenders of Chinese government, and they're zealous, patriotic people. Again, I mean, this is a very complicated phenomenon. I won't go through the details, but if you ask me, I would say this is also part of the paradox between cosmopolitanism and nationalism that we witness among today's overseas Chinese men and women.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah, and that really comes out in these sort of questions of how some of these overseas students represent themselves as Chinese and also as men and in dialogue with the masculinities or the representations of the masculinities that are around them. As you've outlined, the role that representations back in China of Chinese people studying abroad and of the kind of people, the kind of others that they encounter there, the way they interplay in everyday experiences of Chinese people who are actually studying abroad. In a sense, this encapsulates many of the concerns of the entire book, which plays off really well the representations and the sort of everyday practice side and the entanglement really of masculinity and all these questions of nationalism, of the rise of China and of the importance of China to all of our lives now. Thank you so much, both of you, Derek and Gong, for talking to us today. We've taken up a fair bit of your time at different times of day in the UK and in Hong Kong. Perhaps before we go, we could just ask you our traditional final question, our New Books Network final question, namely, what is it that you're working on currently? Derek, why don't you go first to say what you have currently in the pipeline?
Well, it's probably more what am I not working on currently, given the pressures on my time. But I am finding some time to work on an article with Sula Jo, one of the contributors to the volume on masculinities in Hajin's work in the novel Waiting. So a different novel from the one that's examined in the volume. I'm also working on a book project on middle-class masculinities in China, and really trying to bring to the fore the class element that has been talked about throughout today's discussion. I think at the same time, I'm also endeavouring to start a looking at masculinities in visual culture a bit more seriously. And Gung's done an awful lot of work on this. We'll be looking at various visual sources and in contemporary China. So a variety of things going on there, but I think masculinity is still the central element.
That's a pretty inspiring level of creativity and industry, really, I guess, which continues the book outputs that we discussed right at the beginning. Fantastic. Gong, how about you? You mentioned earlier a current project. Could you say a little more about that?
Yes, as I mentioned earlier, I'm working on a book project, and the title of which is Televising Chineseness. gender politics and nationalism. So I've finished the most part of it. The book looks at a variety of gender-related relationships, like between sexism and nationalism, women, the body and the nation, kinship and the nation, that's emerged in popular entertainment. And so hopefully it will reveal an interesting yet little explored side of Chinese nationalism in the contemporary context. So masculinity is also involved, but the book is not exclusively on masculinity. It will also touch upon women and the femininity. Because gender, I mean, for me, gender is not just an identity, but also gender is about the reproduction of the nation. Because gender is what you look forward, what you expect from your next generation, right? Both physically and intellectually, how properly nurture the next generation. So this book is basically, I will still use textual analysis as the main method. But also, I have done some field work, interviews with TV audiences and producers in China. So this is also, it will be interdisciplinary and multiple method project.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
Having mentioned at the beginning that gender and such angles are not always the most commonly adopted when looking at contemporary China, well, it perhaps seems that between the two of you, you are more or less single-handedly or dual-handedly countering that entire deficit and really producing a huge amount of stuff that will be of enormous value, I'm sure, to anyone interested in any of these questions. In any case, though, thank you both so much for appearing on the show today. It was really great talking to you.
Thank you very much.
And to you. Thank you very much.
And listeners, thanks for listening, as ever, to New Books in East Asian Studies, which is a podcast on the New Books Network. We will speak to you next time. Goodbye.